We're going to go back to Lihue Town and the GMO Symposium. McConnell's playing a little warm-up music. Thanks for listening to your community radio station, KKCR.
Either this or KKCR. Personally, I would have chose KKCR, but...
I'm not gonna go on, no, 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 I'm not gon
So the story is told, as the echo of our song, all eyes rest upon Ki'ilawe.
So aloha, ahi ahi kako. Good evening, everyone. Aloha. Mahalo. So I'd like to introduce our speakers for this evening. They're from Delhi, India. After a 54-hour plane ride, a snowstorm in Tokyo, two nights in the Tokyo airport, but very resilient and lovely and graceful through the whole thing. Please welcome Dr. Vandana Shiva. From the Center for Food Safety in Washington, D.C., Mr. Andy Cambrell. And all the way from the island of Molokai, Walter Riddy. And so to open the evening, some of the students from Kanui Kapono Charter School in Anahola are going to help us to give a blessing for this evening.
Thank you. Here I stand on this land, the sacred home of many, where the richest beauty of nature cannot be measured, where most of us unite as a tribe of people striving to live off of this bountiful earth, where many give birth to the next generation, of whose hands will grasp each crevice of this majestic clay, molded, cultivated, and cherished by the descendants of chiefs whose feet have walked these captivating beaches. So why compromise this beautiful and most wonderful life with wandering minds seeking homogeneous lives, when the fact of the matter is that the lands should be freed from the palms of greed? Our mother has provided us with all the green we truthfully need. Abundant organic seed. We all need to remember to breathe, feeling the infinite breeze, bringing us back to how and what we are here to be. Mahalo.
If you look at our leaves, you see green. If you look at our water, you see blue. The beauty of it is unquestioned. But if you look inside, you see deep despair. We choose to ignore the anguished cries, the pleas for help. Our land is being abused, and we ignore the bruises. The actions we take will have consequences for generations to come, because the future is for our children, not us. We don't want to be the ones who simply bear witness. We want to be the ones who stop the injustice, who put an end to the atrocities. Our land might not have a voice, but we do. To save ourselves, we must save the land. And to quote an amazing and inspiring man, there is sufficiency in the world for man's need, but not for man's greed. Thank you.
Neoto, how are you?
How's everybody doing?
Aloha, aloha e na akua e na aumakua e me na kupuna no kia aina. My name is Kalalea Kamahalo Nui o Kalani Kauhane, and we are a part of Kanui Kapono representing, but we're not only here representing Kanui Kapono, we're here repping future stewards of this land. And we're here representing as the next generation, and We're actually here and honored to be able to greet this amazing group of guests that's come here to share their knowledge with us. And we just want to mahalo Dr. Vandana and Uncle Walter and Uncle Andy for just coming here and spreading their aloha and just spreading knowledge through us, that we may come together, all of us, which is why we're all here probably, to unify, to speak against, and I guess collaborate to see what we can do with our future Kauai and how we want it to look. And we are just here to observe and take control as the next generation. So mahalo, and Enjoy.
Ano ai me ke aloha ya oko pakahi apau e na hulu mamo like ole. Greetings to you, birds of many feathers. My name is Mehana Vaughn. It's my honor to offer the pule here tonight, the blessing, on this occasion of Vandana Shiva's visit to our island of Kauai. Today also marks the 120th anniversary of the unlawful seizure of our Hawaiian government. And today we also remember another woman of extreme courage, graciousness, and tremendous brilliance, our Queen Liliʻuokalani. Kalani. Our pule tonight will be offered maka olelo Hawaii, in Hawaiian, but I want to give you a bit of a translation. And I hui kalamaiaʻu ki koʻukua. Sorry to face my back to all of you. So that you may offer your own intentions and the aloha of your ancestors. So tonight we will give thanks to the creator of all things, the earth, the heavens, the sea, and give thanks for the wondrous beauty of this creation. We will give thanks for Kauai, our beautiful special island home, and for the homelands of each of our speakers tonight. We will also remember and honor all of the many hands in kupuna who have turned down to care for the land and for the seeds across this earth for generations. We will give thanks to the many people who've worked so hard to make this event possible. Let's please put our hands together for them. And we ask blessings upon each of you. Thank you for taking the time to be here. And we'll ask blessings on your safe return home to your families. And finally, we will ask humbly for honesty, for wisdom, for unity, for courage, and for peace, that we may work together with people from all different perspectives on this issue to dialogue with honesty and with truth. To strive for balance and for what is right, and to always stand fast for the life of this land. For it is the health of the food we feed our children. It is the health of the land that will feed their children. Nolaila, for our pule, could you please stand and hold hands? E pule kako, let us pray, e ho'omalu kako. E kea kua manaloa, nauno ihana na mea apau, mai luna ai lalo, mai uka ai kai. Mai oa o kia pai aina nei. Nuanui ko mā ko mahalo. I ka nani lua ole o Kauai o kamawai lua lani o mano kalani po. Mahalo hoi ina aina like ole o Darundan ma India o Moloka Inui a Hina o Texas hoi a mahalo no na kupuna o kia mau aina. Mahalo no na lima a pau i huli i lalo i mālama ka aina no na hanauna he nui. Mahalo ho'i no na lima, i hui pu, i ho makaukau, i ke ia hui, kia ahi ahi. A mahalo no na po'e apau, i a koa koa pu. Mahalo ho'i no Vandana Shiva, Walter Riddy, Andrew Krimble, a me ko lako mau ohana, e ho'o po mai ka'i oi, a lako pa kahi apau, a hiki a lako ke ho'o mau, i ka lako hana pono i. E olu olu e ke akua, e ho mai ke aloha. E ho mai ka mana o i'o, e ho mai i ka vivo ole, e ho mai i ka lokahi, e ho mai i ka lokahi, e ho mai i ka maluhia, e ho mai i ka na'auau. Ahiki a mākou, ke kuka kuka me ka pono, ke imi mau i ka pono, a ke kupa a mau i ka pono o ka aina, ka ea o ka aina, ke ola o kou kākou mau keiki a me nahanauna e hiki mai ana. E kupu, e ulu, e ola. Āmene. Mahalo.
Mahalo, Mehana, mahalo, Hamana, Kanui Kapono Charter School. Thank you for reminding us why we are here this evening. My name is Nancy Redfeather. I come from Kona on the island of Hawaii. It's my great pleasure to be here this evening. I warmly welcome all of you to the third of our public forums this week, entitled Raise Awareness and Inspire Change. These forums have been made possible through the generous support of Hawaii Seed and its affiliate organizations on all of the five islands, the Cirrus Trust, and the Center for Food Safety. And I want to mahalo everyone for this beautiful festival that you have put on for us this evening. I feel so connected to everything that I'm sticking to everything. So to open our forum this evening with a mele that he was also performing yesterday in... Same one. In the rotunda of the Capitol, as hundreds of charter school students marched from Bachman Hall to the rotunda at the Hawaii State Legislature and were pa'iai the kalo in the rotunda with the Senate on one side opening the 27th session of the Hawaii State Legislature and the House on the other side opening their House. And so all of the students were in the center for the morning, and the community was really brought into the Capitol yesterday. So mahalo to everyone who made that possible. So I would like to introduce our very own Makana tonight, who has definitely inspired us with his courageous acts and truthful lyrics over the last years. Please give a warm welcome to Makana.
With this man at your back, you can do anything. In 2011, I wrote the anthem for Occupy Wall Street. And I took that and I rewrote it for why we are here tonight. So I'm going to start with this song. I don't have a name for it, maybe you can name it.
Ye come here, gather round the farm. The time has come to sound off the alarm against the ones whose practices disarm our right to grow and eat food without harm. From underneath the cloak of corporate law, the agribusiness attorneys do draw. immunity for products that are flawed. And once released, can never be withdrawn. We'll occupy the fields, we'll occupy the courts, we'll nullify the patents on our food. We'll intrude until we can sow seed without being sued. Starvation comes not from nature's lack. It comes from those with too much holding back. They use food as a weapon of attack to keep the current status quo intact. You enforce your monopolies on seed by waging war against the common weed. We subsidize your cheap and toxic feed. It's all a game of greed disguised as need. We'll occupy your fields, we'll boycott you in stores, we'll nullify your patents on our food. We'll intrude till we can sow seeds without being sued. Our planet was woven by a thread of infinite diversity, well fed. The DNA disrupted does instead result in crops and cattle dropping dead. You claim the safety of your GMOs and of the real effects nobody knows. The FDA regurgitates your prose, and what you cannot prove you just suppose. We'll occupy your fields, boycott you in the stalls, we'll nullify the patents on our food. We will feud till we can grow seed without being sued. We'll uproot all your fields, boycott you in stalls, nullify the patents on our food. We'll renew the right to sow our seeds without being sued. We are the many, and it's our food.
Aloha, this is Keola Beamer, and you're listening to Kauai Community Radio, KKCR Hanalei and KAQA Kilauea.
Thank you. I've got one more song for you. When you came in, you may have been handed a sheet with lyrics on it. Do you have that? I got off the plane today, and I went to Inkspot and had them printed for you so that you could follow the story. And what I'm going to do in a few minutes is I'm going to sing what these amazing human beings are going to teach you. And this song, I have to honor Bob Dylan because I did borrow his melody. Just borrow. After we finish this battle, we're going to work on the whole song copywriting thing. But anyway. All right. This is called The Story of the GMO.
Genes and shots go up in the biotech lab of Dr. Pustai at the Rowlett Institute. He sees the test rats getting sicker by the day. tries to go public, but gets threatened with a suit. Here comes the story of the GMO. It's on your plate and you probably don't know. No real tests were ever done. Just a big PR push and one company controls the food of all the world. Meanwhile, far away in the land of the free, Michael Taylor carefully crafts new laws. Newly appointed to the FDA, secretly working for Monsanto's law. When a scientist would raise a safety question, he would just ignore it at his own discretion. Maybe he knows what they don't know, like how each garden will grow. A Monsanto is sold. You see, scientific proof is a costly task. He thought it unnecessary to ask. Let the biotech firm self-regulate. I'm sure they'll keep all their records straight. All the politicians nodded their heads. They were already in Big Agra's bed. So GMO had no rules to follow. And though the so-called science was quite hollow, the traffic light was green on the great big egg machine. Soon after came the GM bovine drugs. Objections from researchers were squashed by thugs. 10,000 cows got infected teats. They approved it anyway, and now it's in your milk and meat. The regulators ain't working for you. They sold you out and you ain't got a clue. It must be safe, I heard you say. I don't believe that if I play with the health of our children now would be. Oh, Monsanto and the others, they all make great claims of feeding the world and the pests they overcame. But yields are shrinking and the pests are getting bigger. And no one knows what's coming because they pull an early trigger. Remember the butterflies and bees that all died. And the 250,000 farmer suicide. You think you might start asking why? Many living things would die from a thing that's meant to feed the world. Well, the makers of Agent Orange and Roundup 2, we're all excited over a new breakthrough. Just before the patents on the herbicide was up, they found a way to keep the farmers drinking from their cup. They built their product right into the crop. Turned Mother Nature into their own shop. Now they can patent all the food. But family farmers are sued for the crime of saving a seed. That's it, I decided the four of us are going to the White House. We're going to sing this for Obama. And all the cheerleaders talk of ending world starvation. But it ain't from lack of food, it's from economic segregation. They say genetic engineering is as old as growing food. But we know it ain't the same, in fact it's way more crude. It ain't science when you're aiming a gun. And praying the DNA don't come undone. They're playing cowboy with your genes. Ignoring all the unforeseen risks. They made a laboratory of Hawaii. $50 shift in nations labeled transgenic food. But out here in the U.S., the consumer's getting screwed. It didn't change the price of food to label it elsewhere. Now they're spending millions just to keep us unaware. This is the story of the GMO. It's on your plate and you probably don't know. There never was a dry run. Put on a grocery shelf, not one test to prove the safety of the food.
Mahalo, Makana, mahalo for raising these issues to inspired art. Thank you. So some of the students that were up to do the opening have left their shoes in the row that they were sitting in. They cannot go home, so if could you please pass the shoes down? Or if you see a bag on the floor that's not yours, would you pass that to Tiana? Thank you. So all of us, every one of us has kupuna and elders and ancestors that at one time or another had their hands turned to the soil. And this deep knowledge still lives in our DNA. The Hawaiians had great field systems, lo'i, and fish ponds. And for 1,500 years, they had an incredible food system in the Ahupua'a that fed a population that is as great or greater than we have today. The Hawaiians understood very well, Emalama oi ika aina, Emalama ka aina ya oi, that if you take care of the land, then the land will take care of you. So we know that today, we know that our health is directly related to the quality of the food that we eat, because the life force, the mana, lives in that food. And that food, the quality of that food, is directly related to the quality of the soil that it comes from. And the quality of the soil that it comes from is directly related to the practices of the farmer who farms that soil. So our food is directly related to our farmers. We are what we eat. And as in the food, so in the mind, not only are our bodies affected by what we eat, but our very thoughts are affected, our emotions, our ability to have a spiritual life, said Rudolf Steiner in 1924. So our kupuna, our elders, our ancestors have really given us everything that we need to know in order to pass on to future generations. They have instructed us on how to care for the land and the people in such a way that we are in balance and harmony with the world around us, and that we need to do this in order for generations to live. So our first speaker tonight, many of you may know, Walter Riddy, was born and raised on the island of Molokai. And for those of you who don't know him, in 1975, Walter came together with a group of young men from Molokai, George Helm, Emma Luli, Charlie Maxwell, and they joined together and decided to take back the island of Kaulawe from the military. The military, as you know, had been using it as a bombing range.
and they were very successful. And so that started Walter out on a path of activism. And since that time, Walter has really been a tireless champion for Hawaiian rights, the rights of communities, the rights of the water, the rights of the land, and not only on Molokai, but really all across the state of Hawaii. Walter is an educator. He's an avid fisherman, hunter, and planter since he was a child. And for the last 7 years or so, he has tirelessly campaigned across the state for the protection and preservation of Halo a ke kalo, the Hawaiian taro. I feel very blessed to be standing behind Haloa tonight. Stopping big cruise ships from docking at Molokai, or saving the lovely lands of La'au, and speaking out about the idea of no ownership of life has really occupied Walter's time over the years. So tonight I want to tell a Walter Reedy story, okay? Everybody got to tell Walter Reedy's story this week but me. So, okay, so this is my Walter Reedy story. So one Friday I was in my office and I got a phone call from the science editor of the Honolulu Advertiser. And he said, have you seen the agenda of the Department of Agriculture at their meeting next Tuesday? And I said, no, I don't look at their agenda. And he said, oh, you should go online and look at it, like right now. So I looked at it, and they were going to be discussing the trial of genetically engineered pharmaceuticals that were going to be engineered into algae, 7 different medicines. There was AIDS vaccines, hepatitis C vaccines, and these were going to be engineered into our most common water and soil alga in the state of Hawaii, Clementimonas reinhardii. And so they were going to be grown out in kind of big plastic bags on the oceanfront at Mira Pharmaceuticals in Kona. And so at the Tuesday meeting of the Department of Agriculture, they were going to okay this field trial. But it hadn't gone through USDA or APHIS or anything. It was just kind of put through. And so he suggested, you know, I should come over and say something about this. So that morning, all my colleagues that I work with had left and gone to Europe. And there was no one around. And so I spent the weekend trying to call out to Kahea, out into the state, people who might be able to come over to make testimony on that Tuesday. So as it happened, Sarah Sullivan and I went over there that morning. We flew over and we came into the room and sat down and were waiting for the 9 members of the Department of Agriculture board to sit down. And there was no one there except all the scientists from all these companies that had genetically engineered these algaes. And it was kind of a scary moment because the room was filled with people that were going to testify for this experiment. And I could only see 2 of us in the room that were going to testify against the experiment. And so the meeting started and everyone was getting up to say all the wonderful things that would happen because you could make pharmaceuticals so cheaply by doing this and, you know, whatever. And so as I was just thinking that all was lost here, the doors open and 2 young men step inside, Hanahana and Kalani'ua, Walter's 2 sons. And they like this. And they have on bright yellow t-shirts. And on the front of it, it says, Hawaiian Security Force. I could see some of the members of the board of and then Walter walks in between them. My hopes were lifted. They go to the back table and they sign in.
Some of the local guys on the Board of Agriculture were kind of shaking at that time. I'm thinking, oh, this is good. Okay. So they all, when it's time for them to give their testimony, they come up to the table, all three of them together. I've never really seen this happen at the Department of Agriculture. I mean, usually it's one person at a time that comes to testify. So they all come and sit down, and then they just go right down the row, and they all give their mana about why this is a really bad idea to grow pharmaceuticals in the most common alga. You know, I mean, this could, if one drop got out onto out of the bag, it could actually solarize up into the air. It could mix with other water in the area. It could just freely exchange its genes. It could go up and move in a cloud and rain down on something. Of course, we didn't know that at the time, but we learned all this later. So this actually was quite serious. So as the boys were speaking and Walter was speaking, all of a sudden the board started getting very agitated. And when he was finished, some of the local guys that were on the board started questioning the other guys that, you know, this probably isn't a very good idea. They got into an argument, and it started to get really heated. And Sandra Kunimoto, who was the chair at the time, was pounding her gavel on the table and telling everyone to stop, you know, to just calm down. And so that day, that field trial was stopped. So, mahalo, Walter, to you and your ohana, because many, many times you have come to the aid of all of us, and really your dedication to this has really helped to change the course of history. So please, a warm welcome for Walter Biddy from Moloka.
Is that okay?
Sure.
I'm just going to stick it in your pocket.
Aloha Kauai. I want you to know that this island is very famous on the island of Molokai. We all know that Kauai was never conquered by Kamehameha. And we know that it was because of Kauai that these cruise ships are not going island to island. We have a lot in common between Kauai and Molokai, and I'm really, really glad to be here. And I have to admit that I came here, well, I didn't come here to do it, but I stole one of the most precious things that came from this island of Kauai, and her name is Loretta Pereira. From Kala Hill. You know, this week has been like, oh, you know, sometimes your weeks go like this, and then sometimes it goes like this. This week it has just been going like this. And tonight it's like, wow, I couldn't believe my eyes when I came in here. You know, I had to ask myself, wow, what's happening on Kauai, you know? We don't have a room, you know, on Molokai, is just like this section would fit in our biggest room. And this is like, wow, you know. And this has been happening all week. Beyond expectation, what has been happening. So the first thing I'd like to do is kind of like say mahalo, yeah? You always need to kind of step back and say mahalo. And I want to look at that lady over there and give her a really big look, you know, of aloha and aloha to her for coming all this way, going through snowstorms and everything else, and coming to Hawaii to share her mana'o. And this guy right here. He's the guy that taught us the intricacies of this GMO stuff, along with Bill Fries over there. Bill, aloha, Bill. We didn't know anything about GMOs. Nothing. If any of you try to sneak onto the island of Molokai, good luck, okay? Because you cannot come in our airport without everybody on the island knowing who came on our island. The only corporation that was successful in sneaking onto our island of Molokai was Monsanto. Monsanto. That tells you that these guys are sneaky experts. Sneaky, sneaky. Because they were there a good 4 to 5 years before we even know or knew that they were there. I mean, it was like, wow. They're scary. So the first thing we did was to find out, well, who are these guys? And then we went onto this magic thing called computer and this thing called Google. Wow. You should try that and Google these guys, Monsanto. You're going to blow your mind. These guys are bad guys. We had bad guys on our farmlands. Bad guys. The trail that they left behind, of all the places that they've been, we were really, really scared about what was going to happen to our island. So what is happening to Molokai is happening to Kauai, big time. I came early. We took the early flight, got up about 4 o'clock this morning so that we could get all our family together and come to Kauai because we needed to go and look what was happening to you to see if it was the same thing happening here as it was happening on Molokai. And sure enough, we went down to Hanapepe. And the first place we stopped was at the salt pond. And we looked at the salt pond. And if you look from the ocean and you look above the salt ponds, you're going to see the fields that they're growing up there, all of the GMO fields. And any fool knows what happens to farmers up in the fields, especially when they leave the lands bare, which is what they're doing on Molokai also, that everything goes downhill. People there were telling us stories about great die-offs of our sea urchins in that area out in the ocean. And we talked to some of the people that were living there. On the island of Molokai, we are fiercely protective of our natural resources, because that is the way that we survive on the island of Molokai. We know that we have two ways of surviving. We have two economies on our island. One is a cash economy, and the other is a subsistence economy. And we need both of them to survive. Most of the islands have lost one of their economies, and they have been left with just a cash economy. So we fiercely protect the environment because that's how we feed our family. 33% of everything that we eat comes from our natural resources on Molokai. The skills that allow us to harvest these resources and feed our families are traditional skills. Monsanto and these chemical companies are the most destructive thing that is happening on all of our islands today. It is the number one problem that we have as people who are trying to survive in Hawaii today. It is the worst problem that we have right now. Hawaiians kept asking me, why are you getting involved in GMOs? We have sovereignty to take care of. We have our rights to protect. We have to enhance these things. Why are you wasting your time on GMOs? It's like, if we are not going to learn how to feed ourselves. We can never, ever be independent, self-sufficient, and sovereign. Never. Never. I got involved in politics this year, big time, because I was at the legislature last year, and two things happened to me. One, we went there to say to them, we wanted to have a hearing to let you know of the impacts of GMOs on our children. We wanted to let you know of the impacts of GMO on our lands and on our reefs and on our water and of our air and even into the forests. And this is what happened. They put the couple sticks up. They wouldn't even allow us to have a hearing. We couldn't even say one single word to this body that we elected. The state capitol shut their doors on us. And that was a horrible, horrible feeling. We tried to talk as loud as we could. We were yelling from the rotunda. Uncle Jerry was there. We were trying to tell our story, even though they shut all the doors on us. We were yelling, Calvin, say, we were yelling everybody's names, you know, hear our bill, and nothing worked. We couldn't get anywhere. So I hung around, and what I saw was a war on our environment. These elected officials have joined the corporations and they have declared war on our environment. And this island has the most to lose because this is the most beautiful island in all of these islands that we have in Hawaii. The most beautiful. You have the most to protect. On Molokai, we fight over water every day. Water is so precious because it's so limited. I was sitting in Hanapepe down by the salt ponds and I was looking at all the mountains and I just couldn't believe the view I was looking at. So if these people are declaring war on us, we need to react. What you have done here tonight is the reverberations of this room being filled like this. It's gonna go out there and it's gonna impact all kinds of things, including politics. And it's like if we just come here and we enjoy the evening. I'm enjoying you guys, and I hope you guys are enjoying all of the knowledge that you're going to get tonight. And you go home, and you get to a super high, and you're all excited and everything, and then you forget everything. Hawaiians call that poho. It's my job tonight to try and instill upon you that no matter how many times we actually come together and listen to each other talk is not just going to solve our problems. We need to try and get you to really participate, to react, and to understand that politics has joined the corporations and declared war on our environment. And if we don't do anything, we're going to lose because the environment had become so profitable and they have used so much of it already that they're going to do anything to take the rest of it. We need all of you to participate in government. We need for you to follow the lead. You know, this island, Hawaii Seeds. Have anybody in here heard of Hawaii Seeds? Hawaii Seeds. Hawaii Seeds. Hawaii Seeds. Hawaii Seeds. Hawaii Seeds, the leadership in Hawaii Seeds has been coming out of the island of Kauai. It's because of them that this room is full. Hawaii Seeds. Their leadership It's these women, you know, it's these women that have all this energy and commitment and they just go. Oh, they're burning all my ball bearings. I cannot keep up with these women. You know, it's like, the leadership right now, I'm going to tell you guys, the leadership right now coming from Kauai is ahead of any other island, any other leadership that is going on. No other island has been able to fill rooms like this. No other island has been able to get... The other day, we had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people marching down Barataria Street. They had to close off a whole lane in order for the people to march down Barataria. They marched for at least 3 miles in the hot sun, yelling and letting it out all the way down. They organized that. We filled the rotunda. In that rotunda, it was... unions. We had local 5 unions in there. We had guys who was occupying Thomas Square. They were in there. We had children. We had people pounding taro. The leadership was coming from this island. From your island. You know, Hawaii seeds. You guys are in the lead. Just like you were with the Super Fairies. Everybody's watching you guys one more time. Follow that lead. Keep your eye. When you see Hawaii seeds, follow that lead. Okay, because we are going to pass a labeling bill in the state of Hawaii this year. And the leadership is going to come from this island. The other big issue that we presented that day was called the PLDC. Who knows what the PLDC is? Oh, Gary Hoosier, you got some backers, Gary Hoosier. He's going to take the lead. He has the knowledge of the inside information on how all of this came together. He's going to take the statewide lead on this. We need to back him up and follow him on that issue. 2 of the major issues coming out of Hawaii today is coming from this island, the island of Kauai, right now. So you guys, coming into this room, you are going to get information that most people will not have. It's going to be your job to take that information and spread that information. It's going to be your job to make sure you influence that state capital. You have to influence that state capital because things have happened there. The leadership has changed. The House leadership has flipped. That's right. The House leadership has flipped. The House leadership has flipped. That House leadership has been the roadblock. That's why they put the blocks up and we couldn't even get a hearing. It was because of that. And it's gone. So the doors are open for us to come in. I wanted to talk just about, you know, this group over here. You guys are the foundation for Kauai right now. You got all the information. You got the energy. You got the unity right now. You know who to look for. You know what to watch for so that people can tell you when you're going to act. Because if we act all over the place, it's not going to work. You need to go in unison. In unison. I'd like to add, you know, another layer, another foundation layer. And that is the Hawaiian foundation. When we did our march yesterday, it was really, really important to lay that foundation down. So that when we came to our politicians, we were on solid ground. And that foundation was the Hawaiian Foundation. That is a very, very important foundation. We were celebrating the 120th year of the overthrow of this kingdom. And that overthrow needs to become pono. It needs to be corrected. Once that is corrected, that's going to be a foundation that all of us is going to build on, and we are going to make a better Hawaii. So support that foundation. Support that foundation. You know, there's a really great suspect and maybe even fear about that foundation, that if that foundation is successful, if we correct the wrongs that were done, and if we make everything pono and legal again, that how it should be in Hawaii, that the changes are going to be negative. That is a false view that has been perpetuated in order to keep us where we are today. That is a false view. I'd like to give just a small little story to emphasize that point. When we first started out as young Hawaiians, you know, we wanted to go hunting, we wanted to go fishing. They put up gates and they put up fences that we couldn't go here, we couldn't go there on Molokai. They cut off our access. So without access, we couldn't feed our families. So we had no public rights to go anywhere. So we depended on our Hawaiian rights. As Hawaiians, Hawaiians have different rights than the general public. There's different rights. And those rights were handed down from generation after generation after. They were never extinguished. So we used the most powerful rules and rights that we could find in order to gain that access. And people were looking at us going, what do you mean you guys got Hawaiian rights? You ain't got no Hawaiian rights. You know, and we used it so successfully that we gained access to the places that the ranch was blocking and locking all of those years. Now here's the kauna, here's the deep part of the story. The people that were criticizing us were many of the plantation leaders. And they were good people. You know, they were like Boy Scout leaders and community people. And they didn't understand what we were doing. So after we were successful, my heart was really warm, because when Elmer Cavalio, who was the mayor at that time, came to Molokai to open the gates and make a big political deal out of all of it, people lined up. All the cars were lined up because they were going to open the gates in order to go down. And the first car that was lying up at the gate early in the morning was this one Cub Scout master, and his truck was all full of his scouts. And it was a guy that was yelling at us the most about the dangers of Hawaiians becoming having Hawaiian rights. And he and his scouts were the first people to benefit from the use of our rights. And that's the story, I think, that overall story that negates this whole picture. And it's the reality of, if you build your foundation of how we're going to protect our environment on the most powerful laws that we have in the state, then those are the things that we got to do, and support the Hawaiian laws and build that Hawaiian foundation, so that all of us who care about this place, all of us who live in the beautiful island of Kauai, all of us who are environmentalists, all of us who love the environment, who has aloha aina, we are going to be successful if we all join together and rise together in unity. And that has been our story that we were telling at the Capitol, and this is a story that I want to tell you here tonight, that the Hawaiians rising up is not just going to be the Hawaiians rising up, it's going to be all of us rising up together, because we all have that same aloha aina and love for our environment, for our future generations. So, I just want to end by having a really good look at everybody out there, and let all of your mana flow into me, and it's a really, 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 you guys should be standing up here and looking. It's just such a great feeling to see all of you here today, I mean tonight. And I know because all of you have the same mana'o that is in my punavai, in my na'au, that we all are here because we love our environment, we love our island, and we are going to protect it come hell or high water. Yeah.
Mahalo, Walter. Mahalo for reminding us. Mahalo. You know, I just wanted to tell Andy and Vandana, because I'm not sure you heard the story, but this is the very hall where Hawaii said no to the super ferry, isn't it? Did you hear about super ferry? Governor Lingle wanted us to have a big boat so that we could carry the military over to my island so they could go to Pahakuloa. But Kauai, actually, between the surfers and the and all of you, how many of you were in this hall that night? So all the people from Hawaii Island, mahalo you for that night, because that was very courageous. It was very courageous. Thank you. So I have a really special place in my heart for environmental lawyers and environmental judges, but especially Andy Cabral. Andy really has been a champion for all of us, for the protection and preservation of our food, our farms, and our environment for many, many years. He's the executive director of the International Center for Technology Assessment in Washington, D.C., ICTA. He is also the executive director of the Center for Food Safety with offices in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and Portland. He is really one of the leading environmental lawyers in the United States. And Center for Food Safety has really aggressively been pursuing and persisting with this idea of the genetic engineering of food and its effect on communities and on health all across the nation. So in 2012, the Center for Food Safety did some of these things. They filed a petition with the FDA to require the labeling of genetically engineered foods. They have been defending alfalfa and beets from seed contamination in the courts. Yeah, the USDA okayed a beet trial, a genetically engineered beet trial, right in the middle of the Willamette Valley, where they grow all the beet seed and chard seed. That wasn't very good thinking. He has been spending time opposing these destructive practices of genetic engineering and also exposing the practices of factory farming and irradiation. He also is challenging the patents of seed in the courts, and he testifies regularly at congressional hearings and regulatory hearings. He has been featured in many documentaries, including The Future of Food, is the author of numerous articles and books on technology and society and food issues and the environment. And Utney Reeder said he was one of the world's leading visionaries. So to give here tonight from Washington, D.C., way far on the East Coast, to give us his vision of this issue, please give a warm aloha for Andy Cabral.
It is so wonderful to be back on this beautiful and abundant island. I've been here many times now. Just landing is a whole amazing experience. It's like coming home in a way. I want to honor this woman who introduced me, Nancy. Talk about energetic women, Walter. I mean, my goodness. I mean, not only is this woman an amazing woman of the land, if you've ever been to her farm and her husband's farm, it is the most amazing biodiverse place you can ever imagine. It brings tears to your eyes. But she's also one of the most experienced people in the legislature, an incredibly effective lobbyist in the legislature, which is, and done an amazing things on that. She's one of the greatest fighters against GE on this entire, really, the state. I mean, you've just done amazing jobs. And lately, I don't know how you even did this. I mean, how many school gardens have you? I mean, just from 65 school gardens. You know, all week I felt a little bad being one of the speakers saying, well, shouldn't I MC and have Nancy actually tell you all those things? But she adds modesty to her extraordinary accomplishments. I also want to thank everyone who made this possible. Jerry DiPietro, where are you? And a special thank you out to the Series Trust. Kent and Judy, where are you? These two amazing people make so much of this happen. Thank you so much. Kent Whaley, Judy Kern, Series Trust, thank you so much for all you do for this state, this island. I can't resist, I'm sorry to say. By the way, it is true that I was named one of the 100 leading visionaries by Utney Reader. And then they asked us to, several of us, to go to Town Hall in New York City and give visionary speeches. About 5 minutes to be a visionary, as I recall. And I was about the fifth speaker, and I noticed the first four not only wore glasses, but had rather thick lenses, as I do. And it occurred to me that perhaps the prerequisite for being a visionary is that you really can't see at all. So perhaps you should take that into consideration with the rest of the stuff I'm saying tonight. It's impossible with these people on stage that I'm so honored to be with, these two great comrades and friends, not to tell stories, and so I'm going to heck with it. I'm going to tell the first story is about Walter. Yes, I know you've already heard one, but this is a short one, but it's great. So Bill Fried, I know, is out there, a staff scientist for CFS, a great hero too. He and I went to Molokai, and this is right after Walter had succeeded in stopping the genetic engineering of Hawaiian taro. And I remember sitting at a table with Walter and Bill, and we were saying, so what's next? Actually, you said, so what's next? Because you always, that's the way you are. And Bill and I go, we got to do something here. Bill, you and I said, well, patents. Maybe there's some patents on these taro. Maybe there's some patents. And Walter says, they can't patent my elder brother. we went back. Bill and I went back, and I think, Bill, you found three patents, I believe, on Hawaiian taro that went all the way back. And these are ancient seeds. Nothing to do. They've been patented by the University of Hawaii. And we sent them along and to Walter, and that's the last I heard of it. And then suddenly somebody said that Walter had demanded that the University of Hawaii rescind these patents. And then the next I heard of it, there was a chain around the regents in the University of Hawaii. A chain had been, and they were locked into a room, a building. And Walter and his warriors had pretty much said, you're staying here until you rescind the patents. And so the University of Hawaii lawyers, you know, gave him some BS. Oh, we can't rescind the patents because somebody else will patent them, and then somebody worse than us. So we get a call. Walter's not letting him out on that excuse. And he says, is this true? I said, no, it's complete nonsense. Once you've patented it, it's no longer novel. No one could patent it after that. He said, write me a couple of pages, quick. I'll say you're our lawyers. So we wrote a memo. We gave it to them, and they said, he's right. You know, so they gave up the patents. And I don't know if you've seen that picture of Walter and three other activists ripping up these patents. And I've been doing intellectual property law for a long time, patent law. To my knowledge, it is the only time that a patent holder has ever voluntarily given up a patent, particularly under the threat of imprisonment. So, you know, I always say, you know, they always say, if you want something done, give it to a busy man. If you want something done, give it to this man. So he's a great comrade, and continues to be. I met Vandana Shiva for the first time in 1989. My organization, the Foundation Economic Trends, along with an academic organization called the World Resource Institute, held the very first global warming conference among NGOs. And there was about, 60 NGOs showed up, and C-SPAN covered it, which was great because people, really get excited when the television's there. And I had not known Vandana, but she was immediately, of course, the nobility and the beauty of her presence was just to me. I said, who's that woman? She says, Vandana Shiva. I said, okay. So it goes on. It's one of these sort of academic global warming things where they treat the direst threat up to humanity yet as kind of like a scientific problem, And they were going on and on about the developed world and the underdeveloped world and how, what kind of thing. And so Vandana says, makes sort of an intervention. She says, excuse me. She said, in my country, we have for millennia lived in more or less harmony with the natural world. And here in the West, in less than 150 years, you've created a almost terminal threat to the planet. So from now on in this conference, why don't we call you the underdeveloped world? And you call where I come, the developed world. And they did. So I had to go speak to her afterwards, of course, not just, and so we discovered we had a mutual interest in patenting, the patenting of life. So she went back to my office, and we spent a couple of hours looking over patents and trying to figure out how we could stop this nightmare that was just emerging then. So that was my introduction to Vandana. I know most of you probably know this, but I want to review something for you, the last 15 years or so, and the work that not only I have done, but a huge number of you and our coalitions. I just want to sort of remind you, for example, of what we've done. Do you remember the genetically engineered tomato, the flavor saver? Remember, some people remember that? No flavor to saver? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we defeated that. We did a boycott on Campbell's, and that's not here. There is no genetically engineered tomatoes. Remember, there was a genetically engineered BT potato. Remember, Arpad Pushtai was fired for finding out that it could hurt people. Great scientist who was really, his reputation was destroyed by Monsanto. Well, we went to McDonald's, and it's a small campus outside of Chicago of about 4 square miles, where Monsanto lives. Everything there is a Mook, by the way. You get in the van, it's a Mook van. You meet the vice president, he's the Mook vice president. That's what they call each other, I'm not kidding. So we threatened to boycott them, and they gave up, and there went the BT potato, that's gone. Okay, so and I don't mean just me, I mean as a coalition together, we have stopped genetically engineered wheat. Monsanto's Roundup Ready, genetically engineered wheat. Imagine all the wheat products. Imagine the contamination. That's been stopped. That's been stopped through the combination of legal action. That's not here. And they're not coming back with it. Monsanto had to fire 10% of its employees because of that. Genetically engineered rice, been stopped. No commercialization. That's gone. They tried to genetically engineer bent grass. I think it was called Slow-Mo or Slow-Grow or something like that. Scotts and Monsanto. We beat them in court. That's over. That's not going to happen. Then they tried to do these biopharmaceuticals that Nancy was talking about, growing vaccines and crops. Well, we sued them and we beat them. Those are gone. Not going to happen. Not going to happen. Crazy idea. Anyway. Then we stopped genetically engineering alfalfa for 6 years. And we're right back in court right now. Then we just recently stopped the growing of these sugar beets up in the Willamette Valley. And by the way, shout out to Earth Justice in Honolulu for legally stopping that algae experiment forever. So don't tell me Monsanto can't be beat. They've been beat over and over and over again. And we can do it again. And counties have gotten together. I was there in Mendocino County when a woman named Els Cooperwriter, who ran the Ukiah Brewery, said, we're going to be the first non-GMO county in America by law. And Els organized it. I showed up with a great farmer and friend, Percy Schmeiser, who went around the county. It was fantastic because we ran the entire campaign out of the brewery. I mean, best campaign ever, right? We were outspent 20-1 by Monsanto, and we beat them. And that happened not in Marin County and in Trinity County. And remember BGH, bovine growth hormone, that horrifyingly cruel product, destroyed dairy cows. Well, Monsanto started getting in trouble because people started labeling, as you, I'm sure you all know, milk and dairy products as BGH-free. Monsanto went to the Federal Trade Commission and said, they can't do that. That's mislabeling. And we went to the, we answered, no, it's not. It's accurate. We won. Then 13 different states tried, Monsanto tried to stop this in 13 different states. We won immediately in 12 of them. Ohio said, no, it's probably wrong. They can't label. They can't label BGH-free. We went to court and then finally circuit court. And we won. So what did Monsanto do? They sold the product. Gone. So, I mean, you know, recently I co-wrote the Proposition 37 in California. And, you know, we lost 51-49. Yeah, 51-49. They spent $50 million. 50, by the way. 50, $50 million. And they outspent us 10-1 in TV ads. And we still, 51-49. So, they know that we know how to beat them now. And it's just a matter of time. It's not a matter if we're gonna have labeling. It's when. And it would be great if this were the state that did it first. And there's a labeling bill right now that you can support. Now, patenting is not only an economic crime, patenting of life, but it also is disturbing both spiritually, philosophically, any other way. Because under Section 101 of the Patent Act of the United States, do you know what you can patent? A machine, a manufacturer, or an inventor's composition of matter. I mean, how dare they in the patent office say when they patent a soy plant or a corn plant or a pig or a salmon that that is a machine, a manufacturer, or an inventor's composition of matter? That has to stop. It's not only... So, you know, a couple years ago, if I'd been standing up here, I would have said, you know, it's pretty hard. We fought hard. My organization has fought very hard over the years. I don't think anybody's fought harder than Vandana Shiva. She was able to defeat Basmati, the patents on Basmati and Neem. You know, those amazing things. But you know what? There's some pretty exciting news. Right now, in front of the Supreme Court, there are two cases. One we funded, one Bill Fries and our staff and others have been just really doing great work on. The first is a case that says you cannot patent the breast cancer gene or any gene. No genes are patented. And that Supreme Court will look at this year. If they say no genes are patentable, that doesn't just mean for humans. That means every gene is not patentable. So they'll find out. And then in this case, the Bowman case, this courageous farmer has gone all the way from district court, state court, district court, circuit court, right to the Supreme Court. And here's what he says. He says, all right, you got your patent. But once I purchase your seed, your patent dies. I can save my seed. I have the right to save my seed. And that will be ruled on by the Supreme Court this spring. So
hello,
I don't know
everybody.
If we're
this
win,
is Graham Nash. Right now, I'm listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA in Kilauea. Enjoy the rest of the day.
The court is going to have to decide, and we will know. And if it decides the wrong way, we'll let them know, too. We'll let them know, too. But, you know, obviously, the work is not done. And as Walter was saying, you know, particularly, you know, in Molokai and here when we see the invasion of these companies. And I want to say something, you know, Monsanto, I love suing Monsanto. I'm just going to tell you right out. You know, I never suffer from being passive aggressive because we just get to sue them, you know. And it doesn't hurt that Monsanto's chief attorney, a very nice guy, by the way, is named Phil Perry, who happens to be Dick Cheney's son-in-law. I mean, it makes victory a little sweeter. I'm not always a nice guy, you know. But I want to really make sure that we know that there are five major companies, including in this state, that have equal reputations to our friends at Monsanto. And let's just read them out here. There's Monsanto, sure, but Dow Chemical is one of the worst corporations ever, ever. There's DuPont, there's Syngenta, and there's Bayer. Dow AgriScience, that's Dow, yeah. So what I'm saying, and by the way, just three of those companies. Pioneer is a subsidiary of DuPont. See, I know my stuff, guys. And Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta own 51% between them of all the world's commercial seeds. Mm-hmm. So let's not, when we talk about Monsanto, let's make sure we let Dow, DuPont, Syngenta, and Bayer have theirs too, huh? Because they're here, and they need to, yeah, so let's make sure we add them to it. And let's clear up, you know, let's clear up some myths here, by the way. You know, they come in, well, that's, how can you oppose GE crops when they're going to feed the world? All right? PBS. I mean, you see this all the time. It drives me absolutely crazy. Well, and check out the 2009 report by the Union of Concerned Scientists. It has a very good title. It's called Failure to Yield. And it's about what has actually happened with genetically engineered crops. As a matter of fact, genetically engineered soy and a number of others actually have a reduction in yield. Right? And then there's this thing that they increase nutrition. They don't increase nutrition. There's not a single genetically engineered crop that increases nutrition. The one that drives me the most crazy, though, is that they reduce the use of pesticides. All right, let's go over those five corporations again. We got Monsanto, Dow. You're going to memorize this by the end of my talk. DuPont, Bayer, Syngenta. What are all those companies? Chemical companies. What do you think they sell if they're chemical? Chemicals. So what they have done, they haven't done anything for Africa. The lame shall not walk. The blind shall not see. The hungry shall not be fed. They have created 85% of all the crops out there are designed so they can withstand huge, huge applications of weed killers. Normally, if you, the weed killer hits not just the weed, but the crop dies. They came up with a trick. They inserted a bacteria into these crops. And so now you can spray as much herbicide as you want on them. Good for the company, they sell the seeds, and they sell the herbicides. Some large farmers, hey, I don't have to be careful with my herbicide application. I can just aerial spray. Look, the soy doesn't die. Look, the corn doesn't die. What a miracle. All right? So every year, 115 million more pounds of herbicides are poured on our crops. 115 million. 115. By comparison, all the work we've done with organic, and I'm proud to say that I was one of the people that put together the Organic Food Production Act in 1990, and we defend organic like crazy. You know, defend the standards, evolve the ethic, right? We, with all the work we've done, we're getting rid of about 40 million pounds of pesticides. They're putting 115 million more. But now something's happened. The biotechnology companies, and they've met Charles Darwin, right? They didn't do their biology 01. We did, and we've been doing it for years, saying, if you spray 115 million more pounds of this Roundup on weeds, what's going to happen to the weeds? Yeah, adaption. Right? Survival of the fittest. The weeds that can survive, survive, and they replicate, so we have 20 million acres in the United States where you can't kill those weeds with Roundup. Right? So the solution is? Yeah, our friend Dow Chemicals said, you know what? This is great. We can take over the market, and we can have 2,4-D resistant crops. 2,4-D, which is one of the elements in Agent Orange. So then there's sort of a chemical arms race, because then Monsanto says, oh, we're going to go with dicamba. And by the way, these crops right now are up for approval at the USDA. This is not like some future. This isn't science fiction. Now, dicamba is one of the most terrifying weed killers of all, because it volatilizes. That means under certain warm and wet conditions, it comes back up in a cloud after it's been sprayed and can move miles and drop on an organic farm and kill everything there. We even have huge conventional farmers saying we don't want this thing. So our work is not done. And perhaps one of the most troubling things, which is up for approval right now in the FDA, which still has not promulgated the regulations for our food safety, but has found time to finalize the approval of a genetically engineered salmon. Now, the salmon was originally engineered with human growth genes to make it grow larger, faster, and now they put some pout genes in it to do the same thing. Independent scientists have said that fish like this, 60 fish like this, if they're released into a population of 60,000 native salmon, native fish, can cause extinction in 30 generations. So one thing you can do right away is, right now, there's about 45 days left. The FDA wants to hear what you have to say about this salmon. that could destroy native salmon that has less omega-3. Actually, it's a product with no associated with email. So please, go to the Center for Food Safety website, which is just Center for Food Safety in one word, and you can comment directly to the FDA. We're trying to get millions and millions of signatures to say, don't do this. And by the way, please do that. If there's anybody in this audience that doesn't do that, I'll be upset. And you should be upset. This salmon is just, you know, I love salmon. Admittedly, I fish for them constantly. And maybe I'm just trying to make up for being so cruel to these salmon over all the years I fished. But seriously, this is a crisis that we need to stop right away. By the way, the labeling petition now has 1.25 million people that have told the Obama administration you better label genetic engineered foods. It is the largest response they've ever had at the FDA. You can still do that as well. You can comment on that as well. So two things I want to just talk about. One is the process of genetic engineering. The process of genetic engineering is cell invasion technology. I mean, let's take how do you get a flounder, right? I mean, how do you get that gene into a tomato? Well, what they do is they attach the genetic construct they want. This could be the same with a growth gene in a salmon. They attach it to a vector. It can be a bacteria, a virus that invades the cell. The cell tries to reject it. They put in viruses to promote that. And then in every one of those cells, they put an antibiotic marker system. It's usually kanamycin or ampicillin that these little bugs are resisting. So in every cell of every food, genetic engineered food, you've got the genetic construct that's never been there before. You've got a vector that invades the cell, virus or bacteria, that's never ever been there before. You've got virus promoters to try and stop the cell from doing what it does naturally, which is reject this invasion. And then you've got this thing they need to check on to make sure it got in, these antibiotic marker systems. And the last thing on earth we need right now is something that makes us more resistant to antibiotics. That's in every cell of every genetic engineered food. So when they come anywhere and tell you that this is natural, it's like beer or yeast, you know what to tell them. No, not FY. That's not good. So, I also wanted a little bit today to reflect on how does this happen? You know? I mean, there's a story of Native Americans and they're by a river and they see, they're washing their clothes, these women are washing their clothes, and they see a baby coming down the river. And they're terrified, they run out and they save the baby. And then they see two babies coming down the river, and they run on the river, and they save the two. And then suddenly three babies, and four babies, and five babies. And now everyone's just crazy saving these babies. And then the chief comes in, and she says, maybe we should go upstream and see who's throwing the babies in the river, you know? So while we fight every one of these battles, the magnificent battle, which is so beautiful to watch, by the way, and I know some of the people, you know, to stop this grotesque fairy. The battles we're having, each one of us with genetic engineered foods, stop a factory, save a river. Every one of those battles are important. We need to stop the bleeding. But unless we deal with the consciousness that is behind all these things, unless we begin to try and understand it, not just out there, but also in ourselves, there's not enough of us to stop all the bleeding. So we don't just need to work like hell to stop the bleeding. We also, I think, need to spend a little bit of time thinking, why would you do this? You know? I mean, this beautiful ceremony we started, how beautiful the earth, how abundant. Why are you doing this? You know, years ago I went to a USDA research center out in Beltsville, Maryland. It's about 45 minutes from Washington, D.C. And I was doing a book at the time, and I visited a man named Vern Purcell. He's a researcher, nice guy. A researcher out there, and he was putting human growth genes into pigs to see if pigs could grow faster and larger. This seems to be an obsession with these people, by the way. And so I said, why are you doing this? And he said, well, the pig isn't sufficiently efficient. So I said, may I see the pig? Pig 6706. And he said, sure. And I looked at this pig. It could not stand up. Because somehow the human growth genes had the musculature overwhelm the skeleton. So it was collapsing in on itself. and its legs were about that big, just stubbles, could not stand up. It was cross-eyed, impotent, and could barely move. And I was horrified. And I said, Dr. Purcell, I mean, what have you done here? And he looked at me rather cheerfully and said, hey, the Wright brothers didn't succeed the first time either. And remember what we just said about patenting. You're only out as manufacturers or machines. There seems to be some kind of fatal confusion going on between machines and life here. You know, they're treating seeds, they're treating animals as their machines, and using the machine values on these life forms. That's what we call a genetic engineering. This is a mechanism, sort of a mechanistic pathology. This confusion, this technologization of life, which then follows in as patenting, as if you were patenting a refrigerator. So I begin to look into this, and I realize that there's sort of a, I call this kind of a cold evil. This idea that you can somehow treat life as if it was a machine. And I begin to look at some of the principles that are behind this. And one of them is a wrong view of science. One of the views is that science and technology are the same thing. And let me give you an example of this, the foolishness that comes from this misguided science. First of all, you know, my daughter is here filming somewhere, Kailani. Oh, my daughter Kailani is here. And if you were to ask me, Andy, what about your daughter Kailani? And I'd say, well, she's 5'6", 7", weighs 110. Don't get insulted, honey, or 115. And she's 98% water. And some calcium. You'd say, that's not your daughter. I want to know about your daughter. But this kind of mistake of a quantification versus qualification is a real problem with our science, and it had an enormous effect on genetic engineering. Let me give you an example. Do people remember the Human Genome Project? You remember the genes we were supposed to have? Anybody? We're supposed to have 100,000 genes because we're very complicated. Well, it turns out we only had 19,000 genes. Surprising. It's kind of insulting. Well, they recently did the genome of wheat. Do you know how many genes wheat has? 80,000. 80,000 genes. We have 19. So if you take four Nobel Prize winners, Watson, Crick, Berg, and Borlaug, together they don't have this amount of genes of wheat. Pinot Noir has 40,000 genes, which makes sense. It's very complex, and certainly more complex than most of the Republicans I deal with in Congress. Okay. Cheap shot, okay. I'm entitled. Corn has 35,000. Oysters have 22,000. 3,000 more than we have. Houston, we have a problem with the gene theory. A big problem. Also, we share all but 375 genes with mice. Now, mice are nice. Don't get me wrong. But 375, that's all? And by the way, they have more genes than we do, too. So their reductionist science is complete. They don't understand the first thing about life, much less about the genome, much less about anything else. But nevertheless, they try and force the science on us, and they try and push us into silence by saying, you don't know the science. All right? The other thing they try and push on us is, you know, you guys are wonderful, Kauai is beautiful, but what is the number one thing that you want in a machine? Efficiency. Exactly. Efficiency is minimum input for maximum output in minimum time. That's how they want us to treat everything. All right, let's go back to my daughter. I have a daughter, you know. And what if I told you I was a father who was extremely efficient? Minimum input of money and time and energy for maximum input of good grades and good behavior and, of course, minimum time, you know. Good dad? No, I don't think so. I have an English setter, I love English setters, that is the least efficient relationship ever. Food, affection, complete, and she does no work at all. She pees on the rug occasionally. Eats an occasional baseball glove, sure. But that's about it. A friend calls you at midnight, you know, hey, Bob just left me. I'm sorry, I've got to give a speech tomorrow. Inefficient friend. What do we treat the things we really care about with? Efficiency or something else? What's the other thing we treat things we really care about with? Love. Yeah, when was the last time you heard that in a legislature or a courtroom? But, you know, Lincoln said something. He said, you know, the best warriors are the lovers. He said, people who make war just for war are not good warriors. They'll fight for any side. They'll quit when they want. But if you're a lover, if you're a lover of seed, if you're a lover of the land, if you're a lover of rivers, if you're a lover of animals, you will fight. You will fight for that. Lovers are the best fighters. Well, then they're going to tell you, that's fine, but you guys aren't, how are we going to be competitive? Right? How are you going to be competitive? Well, let's go back to my kids again. I also have a son, Nicholas, not just Kailani, and they come back with their report cards. Kailani has an A, Nicholas has a B. Nicholas, you're the weakest link. Goodbye. Sorry, it's competition, son. Competition is the ethic of elimination. If you base your entire society based on competition, it is always based on elimination and someone losing. If people say, we're in a global competition in economics, in the marketplace, we have to win over other countries, that means you're condemning those countries to unemployment, to poverty, starvation. If you go to any anthropology, they will tell you, we did not survive by competition, we survived by what? Cooperation. That's why we love cooperatives. That is how we will survive as a species, through cooperation, and not just cooperation with each other, cooperation with every other creature on Earth. It is long overdue that we realize that human economy needs to be a wholly owned subsidiary of ecology. Until we have learned that human competition plays no role whatsoever, I mean, it's the laws of supply and demand. They haven't read Adam Smith. They don't know they're supposed to produce more when people want more. Topsoil had never read Adam Smith. There's not a single thing in nature that responds to human supply and demand. So we have an entire economic system that is virtually autistic to the actual rules of ecology in this earth. That's pathological. So don't give me competition. That means you know nothing about how this world works and how we're going to have to work in this world if we're going to survive. I mean, Earth will survive anyway. People say, help save the Earth. No, help save us here. It would just be so much nicer if we could see it when it got saved and be here. The other thing they always tell me, they always say, and this happened to me actually, the Burden after, he says, you know, you're a smart guy, but it seems to me you're against progress. Right? So not only, you know, are you unscientific, inefficient, uncompetitive, but you're also against progress. And I always say, progress, that's an incomplete sentence. Progress towards what? Progress towards what? I mean, is the way we treat 10 billion animals that we eat in these horrifying concentration camps, really, that we call concentrated animal food operations, is that progress? Is patenting all of life progress? Is genetically engineering the seed away from its refulgency, its resilience, into something you only can use for 1 year, and it actually is invented to resist pesticide, the destruction of the most profound symbol of fecundity we have on Earth, is that progress? No, they don't get to decide progress. We get to decide progress. We get to say, that is not progress. And not just us. The UN just came out with a report, the ICED report, that said the way we're going to feed the world, this is the United Nations, the biggest experts in the world, they said, is not through genetic engineering, is not through toxic inputs, is not through pesticides, is not through the 2,4-D and the dicamba and the Roundup that is in the dust that's in Molokai and that's hurting and killing children on that island and on this island. So we know it is these toxic herbicides that's in that dust. That is not progress. That can never be progress. And certainly having plants where we're now going from Roundup to 2,4-D, to dicamba, that's going backwards. That's chemical arms race going backwards, and sooner or later, I mean, this is, again, biology 01. What is going to happen to these weeds? You won't be able to kill them with Roundup. You won't be able to kill them with 2,4-D. You won't be able to kill them with dicamba. And according to Dave Mortensen at Penn State, that will mean 700, 800 million more pounds of these toxic herbicides all over the world being experimented on ground zero right here. Right? They'll be resistant to it. We will have hundreds of millions of acres of weeds, you can't get rid of anything. But meanwhile, these companies will have made zillions in selling their seeds and their chemistry, and then they can just walk away. That's this nightmare that they're giving us. That's a nightmare that we need to stop, and that can't possibly be seen as progress by anyone. So we will define progress, not them. We will take over. We'll occupy progress. And one last consciousness thing. I mean, as we have a system that's based not in efficiency. Efficiency is fine for machines, but for a living system that's based in love and cooperation, right? And it's based on our vision of progress. We have to get rid of some of the ways we think about. I have to get rid of some of the ways we think about ourselves. And one of those is as consumers. We've been told that this is a great consumer movement. Consumer? Talk about a mechanistic idea. I mean, they used to call it tuberculosis, consumption, because it destroyed the bodies of its victims. You know, fires consume buildings. They would love us to remain passive consumers. There are no passive consumers on this island, I know that. But I'm saying, all over, in other places there are. And that's the responsibility of each, because we're not consumers, whether we like it or not. Each of us is a creator. Like Walter said. You know, whether we like it or not, every decision we will make in the food we grow, in the food we buy, the food we feed our children, the food that we allow in our schools, in our communities, is either going to progress this terrifying industrial mechanistic nightmare that has now reached its end point in the actual engineering of the seed to become tolerant to these horrifying toxic poisons, or the organic and beyond, which is the fastest growing sector in American agriculture, which means organic, local, appropriate scale, humane, and boy, I mean that with my full heart. Biodiverse and socially just. We need to defend the organic ethic, but we need to evolve that ethic into local, into appropriate scale, humane, socially just, and biodiversity. That's the house. Organic isn't the ceiling. Organic's the floor. And above that, we build this new house of food. And we're only going to build it not in competition. We're going to build it in cooperation. And by the way, let me just say, consumer versus creator isn't just about food. Don't just read a poem. I'm talking to myself, too, by the way. I'm not on top of this mountain. I don't always make the right decisions. But don't just read a poem. Write a poem. Don't just listen to music, though it's great to listen to music. You know, write music. Don't just eat food, grow food. Yeah, that's the way to do it. Don't just watch romantic movies, make love. Stop sitting there crying and do something about it. So creators, not consumers, and participants. Because remember, we're creating only within the context of the laws of ecology, the rules of this great earth. We're not just creators against it. I want to finish by, which I often do, for those who have heard me speak before, with a quote from one of my great heroes, Wendell Berry. You want to try and quote Wendell accurately, because he writes so beautifully that it would be a sin, I think a mortal sin in the Catholic Church to misquote him. And Wendell says, to live, we must daily break the body and shed the blood of creation. When we do it knowingly, lovingly, skillfully, and reverently, it is a sacrament. When we do it greedily, clumsily, cruelly, destructively, it is a desecration. The industrial model has tried to mechanize life. You know, everything on life, there is no unsacred thing on this earth. There's only things that have been desecrated. And in this desecration of our food, I call it the one-night stand. You know, you don't care, you just eat it and don't care where it came from, where it goes. This desecration not only creates the environmental and health damages, I mean, we no longer have adult onset diabetes because so many children have it. And we have an epidemic of cancers, as people in this community know, and childhood leukemia from the toxic poisons of pesticides and herbicides. So not only does that desecration create all those terrible things, but it also puts each of us not just into a health crisis or a ecological crisis, but into a moral crisis. Because it's the job of each of us, including me, not to take part in that desecration anymore. Never again. Hard to do. But the great thing about the food movement is that we can start that right now. You can say, no, I will. We have a guide on our website. You never have to eat GMOs again. We can tell you exactly how to. No, please never, ever, ever, ever eat industrial meat. Don't do it. You're complicit in one of the great crimes of modernity. Talking to myself too. Don't do it. And the other thing about that desecration is it has spiritual impacts on us. Right? It's a world of loneliness, a world of selfishness. And it is a world of efficiency, competition, wastefulness, destructiveness, clumsiness, all those things. So, as you go to the legislature and make sure that a labeling bill is passed this year, as you fight every battle here, I hope we all together, in cooperation, in love, can knowingly, skillfully, lovingly, and most important for me, reverentially, come together to create a new food future. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Andy, for reminding us and for working every day at the Center for Food Safety, and everyone actually at the Center for Food Safety, for protecting the intrinsic value and integrity of all plants and animals. Thank you. Thank you. So seed is the foundation of life. And for the past 10,000 years or so, farmers and gardeners all across the planet, just like you here in Kauai, have been saving seed for the next planting. They have been selecting and improving varieties, acclimatizing varieties, and choosing varieties that do best where they live. Especially choosing varieties that can genetically engineer themselves, the open-pollinated varieties. And in less than 100 years, we have removed the farmer and the gardener from the seed cycle. So, you know, there actually was a time here in Hawaii when the University of Hawaii at Manoa, the College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources, was one of the great seed and plant breeding facilities in the land-grant university system. It started about 1907. It peaked around 1940, 1950. But there was many, many, many very well-known plant breeders. And the University of Hawaii had a mission to be a plant breeding and a seed breeding university. But as time went on and the hybrids came in and then the genetically engineered seeds began, and then the legislature cut money from the University of Hawaii and told them that they had to start patenting things so they could get the royalties to make up the difference. And then when the federal government started only offering grants through the USDA and whatever that would actually support the genetic engineering of these professors, everyone just followed the money. And so what happened was over a period of time, we're now down to our last one left plant and seed breeding professor at UH Manoa. And that is Dr. James Brubaker, who's 85. He's been classically breeding corn seed, tropical and subtropical varieties, breeding all the diseases out of them for 50 years. And when he passes on, there is no one to take his place. So in response to this, the Hawaii Public Seed Initiative was born in 2009, We had a conference in Kona. 120 people came. We partnered with the Organic Seed Alliance and the University Partners. And from that was born the a working group of people from all five islands. And in this past year, through the generous support from the Cirrus Trust, we were able to put on two-day plant and seed breeding workshops on all islands. And now there are 200 new farmers and gardeners across Hawaii that are starting to save seed. And so and really, a great deal of effort has been put into this program by Kauai. And thank you to Paul Massey and Jill Richardson. And Regenerations Botanicals for taking up the work. Yep. I remember when Paul came to Kona and stayed with me to go to the West Hawaii Seed Exchange with me to see what a seed exchange was all about. And he came home, and he's been on fire ever since. So mahalo, Paul. Because still, Oahu and Molokai and Maui don't have a seed exchange yet. But they will after this. So it is my great honor and pleasure tonight to introduce Dr. Vandana Shiva. I could go on and on and on and on and on about Dr. Shiva, but I will not. But I will tell you some of the things I think are the most important. So Dr. Shiva is a doctor of physics, but she's also a doctor of the philosophy of science, which I found very interesting. And she has been able to combine all of these things together, also being an environmental activist, ecologist, author, world speaker, and leader. She was given the prestigious Right Livelihood Award, which is the alternative Nobel Prize, in 1993. She was named one of the five most important women in Asia and one of the most seven most powerful women in the world by the Forbes magazine in 2010. She is the founder and director of Navdanya International, which is a national movement in India to protect the diversity and integrity of living resources, organic farming, and fair trade. Over the past 20 years, she has started over 100 seed banks in India. She has trained over 650,000 farmers to be seed savers. And practice sustainable agriculture. She is a visionary and serves as a visionary leader for world governments across the globe and contributes to numerous food and agriculture, women's rights, and social justice movements worldwide. She is currently advising the country of Bhutan on how to become the first wholly organic nation in the world. So we are indeed humbled and honored to have you here this evening, Dr. Shiva. We know you have traveled so far to come. Please, a very warm aloha for Dr. Vandana Shiva.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all of you. And I have to say thank you to this amazing plant. That is your inspiration. Hello, brother. want to thank the farmers who grew the wonderful food we were served, and the chefs and the cooks, and all of you who've been organizing. I was told you're a very small island with a very small population. It doesn't look like it when you stand in this hall. But I also want to thank those of you who came up to talk to me about what the GMO trials and the seed production and the spraying of poisons is doing to your communities. And I think your island is truth, speaking to the world, that GMOs are an extension of pesticides, not a substitute and alternative to it. Because the myth was, oh, pesticides are horrible, and that is why we have to do genetic engineering so we can, you never have to spray. The early ads of GMOs were, farmers will never have to spray again. We know through the practice in the rest of the world that in fact the spraying increases, and Andy talked about it. But you see it in your daily lives, that GMOs are not a safe alternative to poisons. They are pushed by a poison industry to increase the sale of both the poisons and simultaneously monopolize the seed. And as you talked, my mind went back to 1984, when the worst industrial disaster of the world took place, 2nd December night, in the city of Bhopal. Just called the Bhopal disaster. 3,000 people were killed by the leak of a gas from that pesticide plant immediately. 30,000 have died since then. Most of them were poor because the factory was near slums where the poor stayed. And I remember a poster of the 60s which had an advertisement of Union Carbide, the company whose plant it was, with a beaker pouring liquid over a landscape where a farmer is plying their field. And interestingly, the beaker had a red liquid, and it says, carbide will have a hand in India's future. Of course, they were trying to make it look like it's going to create miracles in agriculture. And what it left us with was with the Bhopal disaster. And the disaster didn't stop in 84. Generations being born today are being born crippled. And two of the women activists of Bhopal, you know, I remember, and they haven't given up their struggle for justice to date. I was with them on the anniversary in 2012. They haven't given up their struggle. They were young women, 26 years ago, much younger. But when they were given a prize, an award for protection of the environment, they took that award and set up a hospital for the children who are being born crippled. And with a little bit of the award, they created an award for other women who were fighting to protect the planet. They call it the Chingari Award. Chingari means that one spark that creates a fire. But Bhopal isn't the only poison tragedy of India. About 2 years ago, reports started to come from the state of Kerala, a tiny little part of it, which grows cashew. And they've been spraying pesticides on the cashew plantations. Of course, it was going into the water, it was going into the wells, it was being sprayed on children. 1,000 people have died in Kerala. It's called the endosulfan tragedy. Endosulfan was a pesticide made by Bayer, but it's now out of patent, so a lot of Indian companies also make it. And interestingly, Union Carbide has been bought up by Dow, which Andy said is one of the most criminal industries. Chemicals were first introduced in the name of the Green Revolution in the state of Punjab. And the Green Revolution was given a Nobel Peace Prize. In the 80s, same year, 1984, we had an eruption of violence in Punjab, literally a civil war, an extremism and terrorism, which also killed 30,000 people. The narrative was these miracle chemicals and these miracle seeds are going to create so much prosperity that there will never ever be rural discontent. India will not have a red revolution, and therefore this is the green revolution. And what we got was a very bloody revolution, with discontent rising. And the farmers started to say, this was, you know, Punjab was a land of prosperous farmers. Why were they prosperous? Actually, my mother's foster father used to be the governor of that area, which under British rule was called the Northwestern Provinces. And, you know, the British entered, the East India Company came in first through Bengal. And the first thing they did was change land ownership laws, exactly in the form that I witness here in Hawaii. Gave the land to large landowners, and the objective of agriculture became make industrial raw materials, sugarcane, indigo for the cotton industry, cotton, and rent collection from the land. It was called zamindari. Sir Chotaram, my mother's foster father, realized what was happening and had a law passed in these northwestern provinces as governor. He's the one who insisted that my mother go to university, that she educate herself, and helped her throughout to say women are equal. And she was more than equal. The law said something very simple, that no peasant's land can ever be alienated, no matter how high the debt. The land, the homestead, and the animals, which in India are very important, that they could never be taken away. So in the East, you started to get this depression and poverty as land was appropriated from the peasants. And in the West, the peasants stayed the owner-cultivators. And that is why when the poisons were brought, they were brought to Punjab and not to Bengal. Because these were prosperous farmers. They were independent farmers. And in fact, and I believe small farmers are the last independent producers of the world, which is why there's such desperation to wipe them out. In the early days when the U.S. Industrial agriculture policies were being made, I remember reading that one of the senators had written, we've got to squeeze the last farmer off the land like we squeeze the toothpaste out of a tube. And that was always the policy, because the sources of independence are a major threat to a system that is about control. So when, within 10 years, the Punjab farmers were starting to feel enslaved because they couldn't grow what they wanted to grow. They had to grow rice and wheat. They couldn't grow it in their own way. They had to use the chemicals. The water that was released for their fields wasn't decided by them or their region. It was decided in Delhi because the Green Revolution meant a centralization of everything, water supply, price, input decisions, credit. And then they wrote, they said, we are enslaved by this system. And they revolted. They revolted with the gun. 1984, that forced Indira Gandhi to send the army into Punjab and the Golden Temple. And then she was assassinated by, I think, 30th of November, she was assassinated. Same year, all of this, 1984. Now, unlike many of you, I've never attended a single class in biology. Never. They wanted us to cut up cockroaches, and I thought it was so unnecessary. So I went into the safe zone of physics. But I was forced in 1984 to ask, why is this model of agriculture so violent? Why are people being killed in Punjab? Why are people being killed in Bhopal? What is this thing called the Green Revolution? And I studied it like I would study quantum theory and found out a number of things that even I hadn't realized before I spent 2 years of researching for the United Nations. The first thing I found out was actually these chemicals weren't ever designed for growing food. They were designed for killing people. And that's why they kill in Punjab. That's why they harm on your island. Most pesticides started out as war chemicals. Even chemical fertilizers have their roots in the war because it's the explosive factories that were refurbished to start making fertilizers. And if you just take your mind back, you remember the Oklahoma bombings? What was the bomb? Fertilizer bomb. Oslo, when that young crazy man piled up so much fertilizer and then blew up the official buildings. Fertilizer bomb. Every bombing, terrorist bombing in India, fertilizer bomb. And for some reason I was at, you know, some gathering and there was a senior security person from the US who, and I'd given a talk over dinner about why industrial agriculture is so wrong. And he came up to me and said, I hadn't realized it. You know, when we wanted to counter the Soviets, we distributed sacks and sacks of fertilizers to the Afghans. And now they're making bombs to kill us. What the Afghanis have is the fertilizers that were given by the US government and the CIA. So a century of war making and destruction is behind the challenges we face. Interestingly, some of the poisons were designed to kill people in the concentration camps and gas chambers. They were nerve gases. They were then modified into pesticides. And I was just thinking, while some of you were meeting me over dinner, you know they had the Nuremberg trials? But who was tried? The poor guard who opened the door. Maybe an official. And Andy said we should go to the source, look at who's throwing the babies into the river. The companies that were making those poisons for the Nazis to kill the Jews are the companies thriving today as the agrochemical industry now mutated into the biotech industry. It's the same. And I decided today, and this is my commitment to you, I don't know how long it'll take, might be take 2 years, might take 3 years, we are going to organize new Nuremberg trials for these criminals. And bring together every community that has been harmed by this continued war in the name of agricultural progress. The people from Kauai, people from Bhutan, Bhopal, the farmers of India. Now, I was woken up to biotechnology partly as a result of my work on the Green Revolution. You know, we live in such a strange world. You can have farmed all your life and you'll never be called an expert. You write one book and you become an expert. So I used this stupidity to start going to conferences where I was invited to give a talk to understand deeper what is happening. And one of these early conferences was organized by a dear common friend of Andy's and mine. And it was the Dag Hammarskjöld Foundation of Sweden that organized it, but Pat Mooney pitted in a lot. And that conference was called Laws of Life, the Emerging Biotechnologies. And all of these companies that are here on our island were there. Not Monsanto, because it was not a big player at that time. It started to buy up biotech companies later. The big players were what are now called Syngenta. And I remember the representative of Ciba Geigy said, "We are too small. We've got to be bigger, and we'll be five companies at the turn of the century, controlling health and food. Five companies." That's the day I decided I was going to start saving seeds. Because at the same conference, they talked about how it was not fair that farmers saved seeds, and how they needed intellectual property laws to make seed saving a crime and seed their property. So the Ciba Geigy person said, "We are too small." Ciba joined with Sandoz to become Novartis, and then joined with AstraZeneca to become Syngenta. If you look at the map of concentration now over the seed supply, most independent seed companies have gone. And as Nancy mentioned, most public breeding is gone. And they would like the last farmer to have no independence in seed. Therefore, one of the big fights we have is to prevent the criminalization of seed saving by farmers. So first we were lied to and told that without chemical fertilizers and pesticides we couldn't have food. And now we're being lied to and told without GMOs we can't have food. And how could it be that a death industry could reincarnate itself as the life sciences industry? That's what they call themselves. Because part of what the agenda is to redefine life as their property, their invention, and just a bundle of molecules and genes. Now, Monsanto is on record in saying that these intellectual property rights laws that were imposed on the world, that forced patents on life, that they were the patient, they were the diagnostician, and they were the physician in writing them. They defined the problem. And for them, the problem was farmers are saving seeds, and they offered a solution. It should now onwards be treated as a crime. And I don't remember, do you remember, Andy? We got together in Penang as a NEEM team. Let me backtrack. 84, we have the Bhopal disaster. And my mother, grandmother have always used a beautiful tree called the neem. Indian name is, its scientific name is Azadirachta indica. I always thought, you know, Linnaeus, the Swedish taxonomist, he gave all the scientific names. I thought this might have been his too. It turns out Azadirachta is a Persian name. Because the travelers from the Persia, when they came to India, they found this tree that was just amazing. It's in India, we call it the village pharmacy. 1,000 uses, including pest control. And it doesn't even kill the pest. Just slows it down a bit. So it can't reproduce fast enough. And that's how you control it. Totally non-violent pest control. And humans can eat it. Animals can eat it. So I carried saplings of the neem to Bhopal. As soon as we were allowed to travel to Bhopal, it took 3 days before they cleared the airport and said, yes, you can now land. And I took bucketfuls of saplings and painted by hand a poster which said, no more Bhopal's plant a neem. 10 years, and we spent, you know, every village we'd take, we'd show farmers how to make a spray for pest control. In any case, when you put your silk away, you put a few neem leaves in our seed containers. We put neem leaves, put in a little bit of neem oil. In 94, we find the neem has been patented for use of pest control. I didn't realize it was patented because the journal only said the world's first invention of neem as a pesticide. I said, well, I've seen my grandmother do it. I've seen my mother do it. Where did this invention come from? Turned out that it was not just a trademark, it was a patent. And there were many patents, but one was jointly held by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and a company called W.R. Grace, which became infamous for the poisoning of the groundwater outside Boston, and a film and a book came out called The Civil Action about housewives rising against the leukemia that spread because of the toxins. So, as a result of all of this neem discussion, on the one hand, we filed a case in the European Patent Office and the U.S. Patent Office. And I filed it with Jeremy. And when we put this challenge, the question asked was, what's your commercial interest? We said, we don't have a commercial interest, we have a public interest. He said, sorry, doesn't count. Only commercial competitors can bring challenges to patents. The public can't. But in Europe, they have a clause for the public interest and ethical issues, and we were able to bring it. We fought the case 11 years, and we defeated the biggest superpower of the world.
You're listening to KKCR, Hanalei. KAQA Kilauea, your community radio station, island-wide on Kauai.
Linda Bullard, who became the president of the International Federation of Organic Agriculture Movement, only to keep GMOs out of organic standards, and worked very hard to ensure that was the case. And Magda Alwit, the president of the Greens. The Greens are significant in Europe. The three of us, we've grown, become friends over time. And, we had the people, we had the knowledge. I'd collected 100,000 signatures for the case. Linda was in Europe, Magda was in Europe. And for 11 years, we could sustain this case just through love and friendship. And that's why I never underestimate the power of love and friendship. And I remember in one of the hearings, this U.S. government lawyer is pointing to me like this. She has no business to be in this room. She's not European. So I just smiled and said, neither are you. Because, in patriarchy, there's this, commonality. We're all bosses of the world. We are the rulers and owners of the world. We are one. And of course, the judge said, yes, that's true. You're American. She's Indian. There's a common interest that brings them here. And you have your commercial interest to defend. Now, the neem was our first biopiracy case. But then there was the basmati. I come from the valley in India, from the Himalaya, where basmati, which means the queen of aroma. I notice you don't have too much rice here because you've got the taro. Why should you have rice? But, normally basmati is now everywhere available. And they always will say Dehraduni basmati. Can't be because our valley is tiny. It's 20 miles by 60 miles. And only a tiny part of it will grow the basmati, this aromatic rice. The same seeds I take across the mountains, down to the plains, the aroma's not there. Because it's not just in the genes, it's in the relationship of the genes, the plant, the soil, the climate. So when we started the big movement against the basmati patent, because a Texas company called Rice Tech claimed to have invented the plant, the grain, the aroma, methods of cooking, we filed cases in India to get the government to mobilize, but I also went to the U.S. and we started in the U.S. And I have to say, you know, the only people available to take up this fight at that time were old church ladies. And they were adorable. They marched with me to Rice Tech headquarters, hands off the basmati. And more importantly, we had a postcard campaign that said, USPTO, US Patent and Trademark Office, if you don't repeal this patent, we will have to rename you the US Piracy and Theft Office. And then comes along Monsanto, which we now know started patenting, created the patenting of seeds through the WTO, now going around and patenting non-GM crops. The interesting thing is, and you made the point about patent law only being about manufacture and assembly of man-made molecules or parts of mechanical things. When we were fighting the basmati patent, one of the things I did was build a common alliance between Pakistan and India, because we both grow basmati. We went to every ambassador of the WTO in Geneva. And I went to meet the U.S. ambassador to WTO. I said, I mean, this is a shame. You know, basmati's been around. We grow it. This is piracy. And you know what he turned around and told me? We cannot challenge this patent because for us, redefining life forms as manufacture is the only basis of a future American economy. I would suggest to all of you, try and find an article in Forbes magazine, 6th of November. I think it's last year, maybe it's the year before. And it's a one-page article, Why Uncle Sam Loves Franken Foods. It's a Forbes analysis. And it's got the positive trade balances and the negative trade balances on everything the United States of America has a negative trade balance. Your shoes, your slippers, your Apple computers, everything is coming from China. Everything is coming from China. The only thing that's leaving the United States is patented seeds that collect royalties around the world and GMO crops. And that's why there's this desperation. And that's why you are critical to this issue, not just for your own sakes, but for the sake of the world. Because you've become like the nerve center for the expansion of this destruction. Andy's already mentioned how so many of the claims made about GMOs are false. As were the earlier claims about pesticides, yeah? DDT will save the world. Yeah? There used to be jingles about it, you know. What a better life through chemistry. But in this long period, I remember, they genetically engineered a bull called Herman. And Herman had human growth genes. And they said, oh, now we can get human milk from cows, which will be the daughters of Herman. You know, the baby food movement is very strong. They said, just like your canned fake milk substitutes were not food, this is not human milk. Overnight, Herman became the source of an HIV vaccine. That's how quickly they can change the objective of their research. And you remember Dolly the sheep? Well, the owner of the company that was working on this had earlier engineered a sheep called Tracy. And when I was debating him, he said sheep are just furry little factories. And now they're mammalian bioreactors. Mammalian bioreactors meant that in their mammary glands they will produce the chemicals you want. In this particular case, it was a human protein. So they had to clone Tracy. And talking about how unreliable the technology is, we only got the story of Tracy and the cover magazine of Time, of Newsweek, of everything, have this image. The creator and the created. Ian Wilmot, the scientist, was the creator, and Dolly the sheep was the created. Dolly survived. 272 of her sisters either died or were born crippled. Without eyes, 3 ears, no legs. You never heard that. And of course, Dolly now is in a museum. Poor thing, she's dead too. She is stuffed in a museum. So if we start to count the failures, 85 had a debate with the person from the World Bank who pushed chemicals on India. And he said, we don't have to worry about the harm of chemicals. We don't have to worry about toxics in soils. We don't have to worry about anything, because now we have the next miracle. With genetic engineering, we will grow food on the moon, on toxic dumps, and in the Sahara Desert. And yet, all they can find is your rich, fertile island. Why aren't they doing these experiments on the moon? There definitely hasn't been more food, the issue of failure to yield, no reduction of chemicals, and such an ineffective technology that the two things they came up with was BT crops to control pests and herbicide-resistant crops to control weeds, and they've given us super pests and super weeds. And I would recommend that you go to the Navdanya website, www.navdanya, N-A-V-D-A-N-Y-A, which means 9 seeds, but it also means the new gift. For us, the new gift is the gift of the commons, the gift of reclaiming life in freedom. And we did a report, along with the Center for Food Safety. We produced a report a year ago because we were getting fed up with the industry lies, to see what's really happening on the ground. And we asked movements and scientists off the place, of Argentina, of Brazil, of Canada, North America, everywhere across the world. And finally were forced to give the title, The GMO Emperor Has No Clothes. You remember the story of the emperor without clothes? Where only a child had the courage to say, but the emperor is naked. And in that sense, we all have to be children, to have the courage to speak the truth. And the clarity to speak the truth. Over the last 25 years, as we've been saving seeds, as we've been training farmers, growing food ecologically with biodiversity, because we didn't begin with bringing an organic produce to the market. That wasn't why Navdanya was founded. We began with protecting and defending the diversity and integrity of life. And for us, the idea of patenting and owning seed was wrong, and that's why the very founding principles of Navdanya is we do not recognize patents on life. We do not recognize patents on seed. And the other aspect was, we've seen the Green Revolution failure, and we're not going to get to go for an even more lethal experiment with the planet through genetic engineering. So for us, the objective of saving seeds, and the only way we could actually save seeds as living and not as a museum, was to grow them. And once the farmers had been trained to grow them, because farmers that had got used to using chemicals, the only way you could get them to use these seeds was by making them realize the benefits of organic. And once they'd grown this amazing stuff, you know, we call a whole family of crops we used to eat forgotten foods that are not being eaten anymore. Because global trade is a very pathetic trade. It can't deal with diversity. Monopolies and monocultures go together. And so we trade in 8 commodity products. And everywhere agribusiness would like to reduce our diets to that. But it's not even that they're growing these crops for food. Food is an afterthought. Animal feed is the first priority. Biofuel is the second. Leftovers come to human beings. And it's such a hugely wasteful system. This is now coming out that the system is a waste-creating system. First, it wastes the rich earth, leaving it poisoned. It wastes human communities by displacing them, destroying them. It wastes the potential of the land to produce. It then imposes uniformity to say, no, if Taro, no, you can't have diverse crops. It'll only grow in one way. So the rest of you are waste. And then they ship it thousands of miles in Walmart trucks, which for transport must have uniformity, for their shelves must have uniformity, and must have a best before date, so half the food gets thrown away. 50% of the food is being wasted after it's produced. In my view, 50% of the food is being wasted in the process of being produced, because we are not using the potential of the land. How many things this island can grow for food? We tasted it today, and there's no reason to be importing 90% of your food. So we have laboriously been working on the productivity of biodiverse ecological farming. And we measure the health and nutrition output per acre, because that's what food is supposed to be about, providing nutrition. Not the weight of what you produce that gets into container ships. And what we find is biodiverse systems produce in certain aspects 10 times, 30 times, 40 times. I mean, I could read you the tables. And we are having so many deficiencies. You wouldn't have any of those deficiencies of magnesium, which leads to attention deficit disorder, or calcium, which is part of the reason the metabolic processes are getting blocked. All of the iron. You grow crops with the iron, you grow crops with all these nutrients. You're going to have the balanced nutrition. Your soil will have the balanced nutrition because you share the food with the soil. We have a very beautiful ancient Upanishad called the Taittiriya Upanishad. And it's only about food. Ancient text, only about food. And it says, everything is food. Everything is something else's food. So, you know, usually they make this pyramid where the humanity is on top. But in the food web, the microorganisms, we are their food. So in the web of life, which is a food web, there is no hierarchy. There are cycles. The constant recycling of nutrients to create the life that we have, not in poison, poverty, disease, but in abundance and generosity. Now, the first GM crop that was brought to India was the BT cotton. And in fact, it was the Bhopal tragedy that was used to say, oh, carbaryl, the pesticide used on cotton, killed so many people. Now we're going to bring a genetically modified plant which will never need pesticides. What has the BT cotton done? Pushed 270,000 farmers, more than a quarter million, to suicide because of the debt related to the royalties that get collected when seed is genetically modified and patented. That's why not only are patents on seed immoral, they are an instrument of war and genocide. A quarter million is not a small number. You know, the entire UN system shakes up and 1,000 people are killed somewhere for ethnic cleansing. And here there's an ethnic cleansing of the largest group of producers in the world, farmers. And if they have their way, they'd like to make the last farmer disappear, like they'd like the last seed to disappear, the last bee to disappear. And just as an aside, I'm thinking, 92 is, you know, the GATT is being negotiated. We've got hold of the treaty, 91. It was called the Dunkel draft text. We called it the DDT, and he said it's toxic. And I went around the country training farmers about what free trade would mean. And we had rallies of 500,000 people coming out. 92, the farmers asked me, what do you think we should really be worrying about? I said, A patents, and currently in trade, Cargill. So Cargill was setting up a seed plant and it distributed sunflower seeds. Cargill no more exists in seed. It has been eaten up by Monsanto everywhere outside the U.S. Cargill seeds is now Monsanto. So I told the farmers about what this was about. And so when the seed failed, something else had also happened. You had a trade negotiator called Carla Hills. And Carla Hills had come to India and said, till this economy is open for our corporations, we're going to use the crowbar to open up India's economy for U.S. corporations. And I'd shared this with the farmers. So they turn up at this seed factory with crowbars. And they literally dismantled stone by stone the entire factory and said, Carla Hills, you can open up the market. We will also pack up your companies and send them back home. But I remember this Cargill story largely because after all this happened and then all of the Cargill chiefs descended on Bangalore and held a press conference attacking us and said we were very stupid because we weren't smart enough to realize that they were bringing new technologies that prevented the bees from usurping the pollen. And before that, in the Convention on Biological Diversity, the Monsanto representatives in defending and promoting the herbicide-resistant crops would say, we now have a technology that prevents the weeds from stealing the sunshine. So you've got bees stealing the pollen, biodiversity stealing sunshine, and farmers stealing seed when they save it. Everyone is a thief in their worldview because they are thieves. And every time we've organized and joined hands and cooperated and built solidarity, we've made them run. Andy shared you the stories of the U.S. You know, I did sue Monsanto when they entered with the BT cotton because, as you said, Walter, they sneak in. They don't come through legal processes because they wouldn't be allowed to. So they sneak in. So I sued them for sneaking in. And then in 2010... the BT toxic gene had been put into the eggplant, which is native to India, and we have 4,500 varieties. And I realized this, you know, they go for the eggplant in India, the corn in Mexico, the taro, here. Because it's not about technology, it is about conquest. And when you want to conquer, you hit the sacred. That's why every time colonialism has come, it's destroyed sacred shrines. And then put churches all over the world. And as Andy says, you know, if this kind of technology is the new religion, that imposing it on the sacred biodiversity and the sacred culture of our food has to be the pattern they will follow. But we'd organized for 5 years since they started the trials. I remember at dinner, we had 130 dishes of eggplant. Even the dessert was eggplant. And our children had been involved, and it was the government was forced to organize public hearings in 7 big cities like this. Anyone could come and speak about why they wanted to or didn't want. Now, Monsanto is so foolish, when they send their bought-up farmers, they send them in identical T-shirts. So it was always very clear, that corner is Monsanto. And The environment minister was going to give the decision on the basis of these public hearings on the 10th of February, I think it was. On 9th of February, I get a call from the U.S. Embassy. Would I meet a person called Nancy Fedorov, another Nancy? And would I meet her? I said, sure. And then I did quick homework. Who's this Nancy Fedorov? She was the advisor to the state Secretary of State on spreading biotech in the world. And she was flying in to influence the decision. Our environment minister preponed his decision and announced a moratorium. But the other point that happened was there was a snowstorm in Washington that prevented Nancy from arriving in time to influence the decision. And that's why when the opening songs we hear, We Are the Many, when I think of We Are the Many, I don't just think of the 7 billion human beings on this planet. I think of the 300 million species on the planet. And we are truly the many if we would keep that consciousness in mind, and that the forces of creation and the universe will work with us because we are working to serve them. We're being guided by them. Through these many years, we've evolved in Navdanya under the larger umbrella of the recognition that we are part of the web of life and part of the earth family. And we have a beautiful word in Sanskrit for it, Vasudeva Kutumbakam, the family of the earth. And in the family of the earth, humans aren't the only creatures. And we are human to the extent we realize we are living among many creatures equal to us. And within that, we then follow Gandhi, who gave us 4 words beginning with S. The first is Swaraj. You can't have freedom till you rule yourself. And when he talked about ruling yourself, he meant every individual. You can only rule yourself if you're grounded within yourself. You know who you are. And then as community. And then as countries. Swaraj. Swa means self. Raj means to govern. So self-organized freedom is how plants grow, how seeds renew, how the planet organizes itself. And that's how our freedom is created. And he recognized that you can't have this kind of freedom if for every activity of yours you're dependent on buying your food, buying your clothing, buying your electricity, buying this, buying that. So Swadeshi, self-making, was his second road to freedom. And that's why he pulled out the spinning wheel. And it was inspired by the spinning wheel that I started saving seeds. And, you know, I drew a matrix. I'm a physicist, so I think in those terms. First Industrial Revolution, textile industry, what did they control? How did we get freedom? Second Industrial Revolution, we kind of missed it with the chemical poisons. Third Industrial Revolution, the biotech industry, the raw material life forms. So what's the spinning wheel of today? The seed. And Navdanya was started with that. But Gandhi didn't just stop at creating freedom, but defending the space for freedom and defending in a highly equitable way. Sarvodaya, the uplifting of all, the last person. And he had a beautiful, he called it his talisman. When you want to know how any action of yours impacts the world, bring to your mind the face of the most vulnerable person. Think of what it will do to them. If it will harm them, don't take the action. If it will bring welfare to them, then go ahead and do it. So it's his talisman of the last person. And I extend it to say the talisman of the last being. But to me, the magic of Gandhi was Satyagraha, the fight for truth. He practiced it in South Africa. He practiced it where the equivalent of your sugarcane plantations were introduced in the cultivation of indigo. Farmers weren't allowed to grow food. They had to grow indigo, the blue dye, before the chemicals were found. And he was brought there when he came back to India from South Africa. He was taken there by our freedom movement. And he lived there. And he went village to village. And he found women feeding the textile industry, having no clothes of their own. Just like today, farmers are feeding the global food system, not eating and going hungry. And he started what is called the Champaran Satyagraha, because the place was Champaran. We would rather die than grow indigo. We will stop growing indigo. And that's how peasants got liberated from the forced indigo cultivation. In 1930, the British said, wow, we can make so much money out of salt. I've just been gifted beautiful salt. And they passed a salt law saying, Indians can't make salt. They had to buy from the British. So Gandhi walked to the beach, picked up the salt from the sea, and said, nature gives it for free. We need it for our survival. We will not obey your law. We will continue to make salt. And we've been inspired by that to do the seed satyagraha. Every time there's an attempt by government to make a law that would make our seeds illegal, I march to the Prime Minister and say, Gandhi taught us, you can write these laws, but we will not obey because we are governed by higher laws. The laws of the planet, the laws of life on earth, laws of human justice. And it is our duty to save seeds. And you do not have the right to interfere in that ecological and ethical duty of ours. So what we've done is taken these principles and applied them in our struggle for food sovereignty and seed sovereignty and land sovereignty and water sovereignty and the sovereignty of our forests and our biodiversity. And we define sovereignty not just as the freedom of humans who depend on nature, but the river to flow, the bees to pollinate, the soil microorganisms to flourish, the seed to give rise to seed. We are living in a time, and this was brought out very clearly by Walter, that the laws that are being written in our lands everywhere in the world are being written by corporations. They are writing the laws. And democracy, in its mutated form, has become of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations, and has stopped being by the people, of the people, for the people. So how do we reclaim our democracy and our freedom? I don't think we can reclaim it only within the limits of representation, given that that representation can always be distorted with the representation of money rather than people. It can only happen by going deeper and wider in where democracy is defined. And that's why I talk of earth democracy. Democracy of all life on earth. That is where we get our strength. Where do the laws of the land come from? From the land. The fact that during a colonial period, land was appropriated and given to sugar plantations does not mean that that wrong can carry on forever and be added with new wrongs. Everywhere in the world, the concentration of land ownership by plantation economies of the colonial time has been undone. We have land reform in India. There's been land reform worldwide. And you know that you can't win the GMO fight alone without reclaiming the land. Walter said something very interesting about Hawaiian law. So, you know, there's the law of the universe, there's the law of the earth, And within that is the law of the people living in and with the land, which is the common law that evolves over time. It's the customary law. The indigenous people, the Aboriginal people of Australia, sued the occupiers. Must have been about 15 years ago, 10, 20 years ago. And they said, you know, you occupy this land, you don't own it. And the interesting thing is, it's called the Mabo case. The judge ruled that these rights of indigenous people and local communities come from natural rights. They are not assigned by the state. The state cannot extinguish these rights. They can, at best, for a few centuries, forget them. Now, the forgetting of those rights to land does not mean an erasure of rights. But the rights of local people are never rights to own and buy and sell. They are rights to serve and defend the land, and the rights to use the land for one's own nourishment. And that's why throughout history, the only land rights that have been there in traditional societies have been usufructuary rights, the right to use. And that's why landholding stayed small, because you can't use too much. Now you've got sugar plantation owners who've stopped planting sugar, making sugar, living somewhere else, selling off their land, leasing it out to Monsanto, illegitimate at every level. So when I heard the beautiful children say, land should be free from the palms of greed, or to save ourselves, we must save the land, we have to take instruction from them. In my culture, in the Native American cultures, we've always had the idea of the seventh generation. That when you act, think of the seventh generation to come. If we think of the seventh generation to come, the abuse of this land has to be stopped. And I just want to share one tiny example with you. You know, Coca-Cola is another big company. It's kind of the Monsanto of bad drinks that ruin your health. And it was driven out in 1977 from India because of corruption and faking taxes. They were thrown out. And they came back with liberalization. And suddenly they were all over. And they started to drill water. I got an invitation from a village I don't know, get a call from women, come and join us for 1 year of fighting Coca-Cola. So I go down because I'm interested to see how Coca-Cola is related to what they're fighting. Every day, Coca-Cola was siphoning off 1.5 million liters a day of water. In this water-abundant area, there was a water famine. What remained was polluted water. And then a woman, six-year-old woman, my lama said, we can't keep walking further for clean water. She was already walking 10 miles. This company has to shut down. So they did a satyagraha, camped outside. I went in, I found 500 policemen and 100 villagers. And I said, no, we got to pitch in and help. You know, I started to mobilize lawyers, political support. And the case went to the High Court of Kerala, where the judge ruled, this water is neither the property of the state nor the property of Coca-Cola. It is the common property of the local community. And therefore, the state does not have the right to hand over the water to Coca-Cola, and the plant must shut down. From 2004 onwards, the plant has been shut down. I'm giving this example because I think it wouldn't be a bad idea to serve notice on the basis of earth law, recognizing the rights of Mother Earth, customary law, the Hawaiian law, both to the plantation owners who are under the illusion they are landowners, and to those who rent the land under the illusion that they can poison without your permission. I know Ken Kawai through the new recognition of ancient concepts of the rights of Earth and the rights of Mother Nature, you are drafting local food sovereignty principles. Because we are at this watershed. The corporations have defined themselves not just as the rulers of today, but as human beings. They have legal personhood. And this fiction, which is not a person, then pretends it has a mind, and that mind can own all of the life on this planet. So we build fiction on fiction on fiction. It's a house of cards. You just have to poke it a little, it's going to come crumbling down. But to do that, we could apply exactly the same Wendell Berry quote to political action. We have to be skillful, creative, loving, reverential. And there is no reason and no way that people of the world rising with their new identity as Earth citizens, in solidarity with all life on Earth, and in solidarity with all people anywhere else fighting against these war criminals who became poison criminals and are now GMO criminals. To tell them, your time is over. We have better ways to produce food. Nature and the Earth is our first employer. We turn your back. We turn our back. You know, this lady, my lama, in the Coca-Cola situation, she pulled her two sons that were working in Coca-Cola out and said, it can't be that I walk further for water and you say you're earning some money. Give up your jobs. Come back to the local economy. And I think we need to tell everyone who thinks their bread and butter is coming from Monsanto that there's a local food economy waiting for them to join the creativity of seed saving. Seed saving, organic production, cooking, sharing. We haven't even begun to explore the amazing potentials of our freedom, our creativity, and our power. That's why I've come to join hands with you. I want to return only when you've driven these criminals off this island.
We're not done yet. Almost, though. Almost. Very close. Very, very close. You know, the ending of things is always most important. Like when you go to a meeting, a lot of times in the last 1 or 2 minutes, something really, really important happens because everybody's kind of held it for the last minute. So stay if you can. It'll only be a few more minutes. So, mahalo, Vandana, for giving us this challenge. And that it won't just be Kauai that loses all of the companies. It will be the whole state of Hawaii. And thank you also for pointing out that in order to change the world, we have to change ourselves first. And that everything we do, as Andy said, every decision we make every day, the food that we eat, what we support, the products that we buy, it all contributes to that final picture of who we are. And it seems like, I mean, I think we all know it's really hard to change ourselves. But when we do, the whole world changes. Yeah, the whole world changes. You change yourself and everything changes around you. So thank you so much for your inspiration tonight. It is just amazing. Thank you. So I'd just like to end with just a couple more words, and then Makana, I think, has written a special song during the evening for you, and then we'll end with that. Because it became very apparent to me tonight that we are actually the generations right now that will be deciding the future for the world forever. Because this technology you can't take back. And so the decisions that we make now are going to decide the health of our children, our children's children, our food, our water, our land, for all successive generations. So this is a big challenge. And we're going to need to have the knowledge and the courage and the desire and the will and the inspiration and to do this work. And I am sure that we can do it. So on behalf of the Cirrus Trust, the Center for Food Safety, the Walter Rudy Ohana, Hawaii Seed, and GMO Free Hawaii, I really, really thank you for sharing this evening with us tonight. And we love you all. And we look forward to coming again.
Before you, Hele, to wherever you're going, where are you going next?
Oh, I'm here for another day.
All right. I was backstage and I noticed that Vandana rhymes with Makana, so I found this old beautiful song and I just changed it a little. This is for you.
Follow here.
Your love is a great thing. Vandana, a gift for the heart.
He Vandana, he Makanda Nagapurai. He Vandana, he Makanda Nagapurai.
Remember, a spark can start a fire. Ahui ho, aloha.
There we go. And that wraps up the Vandana Shiva, GMO Free Kauai, Hawaii Seed presentation at the Lihue Memorial Convention Center here in beautiful downtown Lihue. Hope you enjoyed tonight's evening presentation. I'm going to say thank you to Jack Kiaka, Shaka Kiaka in there holding it down. Also wanted to say mahalo to Dean Rogers for helping us out. We've got a background singing of Aloha Pone Ai. I guess that's Aloha Pone I, if I have that right.
Mau ke aloha, aloha vai.
And that does conclude our broadcast from downtown Lihue. Mahalo for the support in the booth up there and the station. Mahalo from community members who make this all possible by your support and love for Kauai Community Radio. Hope you enjoyed this presentation. We should be doing some rebroadcasting of this in future segments of Out of the Box, as well as other KKCR programs. Exciting to be part of the public affairs team, and I look forward to hearing some commentary from members of our community and listeners like you, and to see how this spark that has been presented tonight and how the inspiration is there for us to enact and move forward. with that, we will be going out with a little junk food from our friends at Wookiee Foot. If you haven't heard it already, get used to it. It's coming to you. Something like this. Uh-oh. What happened?